Introducing set number 1009, C.G. Jung's Seven Sermons to the Dead, this is a BC Recordings copyrighted full-length lecture presentation by Stefan Heller entitled Jung and the Gnostics.
There are quite a sizable number of people, particularly in the Jungian community, who have discovered the Gnostics and Gnosticism by way of Jung and his interests. There is a much smaller number who have come to Jung by way of the Gnostics, and I number myself among them, because quite a long time ago, in fact at the age of about 12 and a half, I discovered in some books something about the Gnostics, and I have been hunting them down ever since, and I still am. And fairly early in the game, when I was going to the university in Innsbruck in Austria, I encountered the interesting and certainly informative truth that I shared this intense interest in Gnostics and Gnosticism with the venerable old gentleman across the Alpine peaks on the other side of the border in Switzerland, namely C.G. Jung. Because it was at that time that I also encountered for the first occasion in my life Jung's curious and creative little poetic treatise, The Seven Sermons to the Dead, in the privately published edition, which was the only one in which it was available at that time, which was only given out to some friends of Jung probably in the early 1920s. And a gentleman whom I met at that time had a copy of it. And I copied it down by hand and carried it around with me all over the ocean to America and all of that, never thinking that eventually in the 1980s, or maybe it was early 1990s, I would receive an original copy from Carl Jung's son, Franz Jung, in appreciation of some of my work for the memory of his father. So now I have an original copy of the Seven Sermons to the Dead, just the same kind of copy that I saw at the tender age of 19, I think, first in the Alps. Jung, coming to his parting of the ways with Sigmund Freud, began a great and extremely intense sort of interior transformational journey, which, at least in its full intensity, lasted from about late 1912 or early 1913 to 1916, about 3.5 years, and that within that period of time, he said, describing his experience, that he descended into the underworld like Orpheus and other heroes of old. He underwent his Nekia, and that he communed with all sorts of mysterious and awesome forces, as he named them, of the unconscious at that time, and that these forces and images and inspirations, the substance of whose communication he had written down in 1,330 handwritten pages, which are still extant in manuscript form but never have been published, in something that is called the Red Book, because he had them bound in red leather, that this material in many ways served as the basic inspirational source material for a great deal of his subsequent psychological scientific work. He stated this unequivocally toward the end of his life. At the conclusion of these 3.5 years, of these 3.5 years of intense involvement with his inner life and with the mysteries of the soul, just as he was emerging from that period, a kind of resounding concluding experience came to him, which resulted in the writing down of the so-called Septem Sermones ad Mortuos, which is the Latin title, meaning the seven sermons to the dead. The way that occurred, you can find descriptions of it in Jung's autobiographical fragments, Memories, Dreams and Reflections, edited by Aniela Jaffe, and also increasingly allusions to it are found in many different sources. Jung felt that something was about to happen. He was in his house in Zurich with his children and his wife, and sort of the psychic atmosphere became increasingly charged, as that often occurs before important revelations of the unconscious, shall we say. Even his children were having strange dreams, and then one day, I think toward evening, his doorbell rang very powerfully and violently, and when we say doorbell, we don't have to imagine a sort of little electric buzzer like we have here, but rather a bell that really takes some yanking and pulling in order to make it ring, one of these nice big hand-drawn doorbells. The doorbell rang violently. Jung went to the door, looked out, and saw no one. And while he did not see anyone, he heard many voices whispering in the air. And they said, "We have come from Jerusalem, where we did not find that which we were seeking." And with that, he said, the spirits were in the house. There are conflicting reports about the amount of time. According to some people, in one night. According to others, over a 2 days and night period, Jung wrote down these seven beautiful, poetic, and certainly very psycho-spiritually and symbolically charged little chapters of a work that he called the Seven Sermons to the Dead. The only reason that I'm beginning my little discourse this evening with an account of these happenings is that the Seven Sermons to the Dead was really for a very long time and also was the very first evidence of Jung's intense and intimate involvement with Gnostic lore. Because the Seven Sermons to the Dead are written entirely in the style and using the symbolic language and sort of mythic framework of early, probably second or third century Gnosticism. It was, of course, rumored all through the many years of Jung's life that he was very close to this early variant of the Christian religion, known as Gnosticism, but he did not make really any statements of an overt nature about it in public. Since the writing of the Seven Sermons to the Dead, till clear right up around his 80th year, when indeed on his 80th birthday he was presented with an original Gnostic codex, the first codex, codex number one of the now reasonably well-known and translated Nag Hammadi Library of Gnostic Scriptures, that first codex or book having been named after him and still is known as that, as the Jung Codex, which was presented to him on his 80th birthday in a public gathering in Switzerland. And when Jung held in his 80-year-old, somewhat unsteady hands this ancient writing, then he gave a fairly lengthy speech, which speech is contained, incidentally, for your information, in volume 18 of Jung's collected writings. And there he quite unabashedly, once again, and publicly owned up to his tremendous interest in and involvement with, and indeed his internal and abiding devotion to this particular ancient school of thought. Subsequently, of course, as particularly after his death, when his autobiographical fragments came out and then various other people began writing biographies of him, in practically all of these, some reference to his involvement with Gnostics and with Gnosticism appeared. For instance, one of his close disciples, all of them, with one or two exceptions by now, are of course also dead, Barbara Hanna, in her biography of Jung, shares with us a great many personal statements that Jung made to her and sometimes to a smaller group of people wherein she found herself. And there are several statements there, but one where he stated very specifically that when he encountered the writings of the Gnostics early in his life, he immediately felt that he was among old friends. And then, of course, let's say all of his ensuing interest in these matters can be really traced back to that. It is also well known now, and I'm getting a little ahead of myself in terms of some later discussions that we may have, that Jung really only began his interest in alchemy, which became a very, very important sort of paradigmatic symbol system for his psychology from a certain time on. I think his first alchemical book, which was probably Psychology and Alchemy, major work, was published in the early 1950s in German. He only really came around to alchemy and developed that great interest in alchemy because by the end of the 1940s, in the 1930s probably already, he had exhausted the then existing original literature that had come down to us that was available from Gnostic sources. The famous Nag Hammadi library, the first codex of which was presented to him on his 80th birthday, was not really discovered until the latter part of the 1940s, 1945, 1946, thereabouts, and did not start being translated until the 1950s. And so Jung was seeking a continuation. Jung was seeking the ongoing connection that existed between second, third, fourth century Gnostic wisdom and the present time. And that is when he discovered alchemy, and on the basis originally again of some dreams that he had about alchemy, alchemical dreams, and sort of the revelation came to him inwardly, which he soon managed to substantiate by external historical research, that alchemy was the living connection between the ancient Gnostics and the later period, including the present day. So we can see that the way the Gnostics reinterpreted the biblical scriptures and so forth, he saw psychological analogs. And he said, if we apply these principles to ourselves, then we find that psychologically they make sense. And that what these old folk back in the second, third centuries in so-called gnosis, this unitive knowledge which unifies, which integrates, and which reconnects us with a greater reality, this is really the individuated state. So Jung saw a psychological gnosis, a psychological application of these ancient principles, but I hasten to add that just because he did this and wrote about it in great and often very practical detail, doesn't really mean that he had no regard and respect for the metaphysical or the transcendental dimensions of these teachings, only that was not really his job to comment about. Except in a few instances, pretty much toward the end of his life, such as Answer to Job and a few other smaller treatises which are not really strictly psychological treatises, although they are always informed, of course, by the psychological discipline, but where he sort of developed his own gnosis. I won't have the opportunity to comment on them in any detail, but I have here a few points, in fact, 12 of them, and they are only a sentence each. These were put together by a professor from the University of Miami a few years ago, Clark Emery, where he sort of summarized in 12 points the principal teachings of the Gnostics. Now, I'll read these off to you, and I'll sort of let you form your own conclusions about the psychological applications of these, although I'll throw in a word or two. Number one, they posited an original spiritual unity which came to be split into a plurality. Let me just throw in. We ourselves come from a state of unity, but the further out we go into differentiation, the more part selves, autonomous complexes we develop, and we are now a plurality rather than a unity. Second, as a result of this pre-cosmic division, the universe was created. It was created by a leader, Archon in Greek, possessing inferior spiritual powers, a leader often having the appearance of the Old Testament God. I spoke of this before. The psychological analog of this would be the ego. Third, a female emanation from God was involved in another way in the cosmic creation. Jung always spoke, anima and animus. And the unconscious wisdom having a feminine tone. So this feminine wisdom was there from the beginning. It is referred to as Sophia. Fourth, in the cosmos, space and time have a malevolently spiritual character and may be personified as ambivalent or demonic beings separating the human from God. Space and time separate us from the authentic reality until we see through them. Extraversion of consciousness, as Jung would call it. Fifth, for the human, the universe is a vast prison. He is enclosed both by the physical laws of nature and by such psychic laws as the Mosaic Code. Well, yes, until we are individuated, until this integrative individuational process takes place, we are imprisoned. Consciousness is imprisoned in physicality. When you strike out, you get angry and you hit somebody in the face, and you didn't even feel like doing it to begin with, what happened? Your body and your emotions ran away with you. Happens all the time. Every day we ask ourselves, hopefully not on very big issues, what made me do this? What made me do this? Similarly, what made me not do this? I had an opportunity to do something good. I had an opportunity to learn something important. I didn't do it. What is it? It's the psychological forces within us that make us do things that we shouldn't do and that prevent us from doing the things that we should do. I think St. Paul wrote about something like that already, Sixth, humankind may be personified at times as Adam, who lies in a deep sleep of ignorance, his powers of spiritual self-awareness stupefied by materiality. Now we have, of course, the metaphor of the first chapter of Genesis. Seven, however, within each natural man is an inner man, inner person. This is a fallen spark of the divine substance. Since within each man this spark of holiness exists, the possibility of an awakening from the present stupefaction exists. In us is something that is the hope of our glory and the hope of our awakening. It isn't bestowed on us, it's in us already, but it needs to be awakened. Very true. Again, psychologically quite correct, would Jung say. 8. What effects this awakening? Now this is quite important. What effects this awakening is not obedience, not faith, not good works, but knowingness, gnosis, spiritual knowledge. Now, of course, psychologically what this means is that our awakening to individuation is a process of consciousness. And the process of consciousness does not occur by believing something. It does not come by being obedient to somebody else. It doesn't come just by doing something good, although doing good is always useful. Consciousness is a reality in its own right. It is a sovereign thing. It works in its own way. It's not made to happen by external things, although it can be supported by external things. It's sort of like, last night while I was going to sleep, I was watching some doggone thing, or some people in Egypt were trying to duplicate the way the Egyptians erected these big, long obelisks. I don't know if some, I think it was on PBS, you know. They scraped out the sand and then, so it's kind of like this. You can do these external things and then you can prop them up and pull them in various ways. So that will help, but it does not build the consciousness itself. 9. Before awakening, humans undergo troubled dreams. Before awakening to greater consciousness, we are involved in all kinds of illusory and yet seemingly very real psychological projections. Everything from believing like Hitler and his buddies did, and I know something about that because I was among them for a while, even though I was quite young, believing that a little bunch of people called the Jews are somehow the cause of all the evils in the world. I mean, how could anything be more idiotic? And yet, you know, millions of people believed in it implicitly, psychological projections, and others, all kinds of weird illusions, you know. Have you ever had even a minor anxiety attack? You know what that feels like? And maybe you are in your bedroom or something of that sort, and all of a sudden you start sweating and shaking, and you have this total overwhelming feeling that there's something awful in the next room. And yet at the same time, your rational mind knows that there's nothing in the next room. Yet you are scared. What are you scared of? You're not scared of anything that's there, but you are scared of a psychological complex of a projection that has arisen and that leads at least part of you to believe that something horrible is right there. These are just sort of the more dramatic events, but they're around us all the time. Until we awaken to a reality that is greater than these. And then they're sort of like the mists that disappear eventually, the fog that disappears when the sun begins to burn it off, they kind of creep away. The real consciousness comes and takes them away. Those are the troubled dreams. 10, the knowledge that awakens man from these dreams is not arrived at by intellectual cognition, but through revelatory experience, and is not an accession of information, but a modification of the entire being. About 5 2-hour lectures could be given about that one sentence. But as you know, these need to be kept in mind. Any kind of psychological insight, for instance, into your situation, is a revelatory experience. It's a revelatory. I don't mean that it's the only kind, but it certainly is one kind. If you ever had a real psychological insight that revealed something about your things in your life and why things have gone wrong or why you don't see things a certain way, it is a revelatory experience. And it's not the same as somebody just giving you information. It's something that comes to you and then it modifies your entire being. You're never the same again. 11, The awakening, that is the salvation of any individual, is a cosmic event. Now, of course, in the original Gnostic view, this was interpreted primarily by saying that every time an individual is enlightened, awakened, whatever you wish to call it, it helps to remedy the flaws in the external world as well, to some degree. Jung, however, would say that our own cosmos within which we live is remedied by more consciousness. And the more people there are around in any one place who are conscious, the better that part of the world becomes. That is the only really abiding way of improving the world. Because other improvements deteriorate in accordance with the unconsciousness of the people around. You give them a wonderful system of welfare or something of that sort, but it's all full of unconscious people. Give it a couple of years, they mess it up, it's going to be worse than it was before. But we know how that works. But where there is consciousness, there is consciousness. Then everything is quite different. And finally, the last, the 12th, since the whole universal effort is to restore the wholeness and unity of the Godhead, active rebellion against the lesser systems, such as the Old Testament law and so, is generally enjoined on everyone. Well, this is probably a little bit of a misunderstanding, but I think still psychologically, if properly understood, it makes sense. It means that there has to be at some point an active dissatisfaction with the way things are, with your consciousness, with your situation. If you always make excuses and say, oh, well, you know, maybe I'm a little bit unconscious, but so what? You know, whatever the case, you know. And you're not really convinced that you need to change, that you're never going to come into your own unless you have a greater kind of consciousness, then there is not going to be any change. So there has to be, at some point, a fairly radical dissatisfaction, in this case, with your own psychological condition before you can really apply yourself to a greater change. Not just, oh well, it would be nice to individuate a little bit, so let's toddle down to the Jung Institute and see what can be done about it. You know, just sort of a blasé California laid-back motivation. That hardly ever does it. There has to be almost a desperation about it. Well, alright, those are the 12 points that Clark Emery outlined, and I think it's fairly evident how, although they are taken from an ostensibly religious context, they can be very directly and very profitably applied to a psychological one. And so, these are really the reasons why the Gnostic wisdom was such an important model for Jung's psychology, why he was so attached to it, why he valued it so much. And, of course, as time went on, there were others, such as alchemy, and we'll take a look at some of those others in our couple of ensuing talks. So thanks very much, and see you next time.
Copyright MMI by DC Recordings, catalog number 100900. For more information about available lecture titles and for many other resources, visit Gnosis.org. That's GNOSIS.ORG.